Nightlife. Bite-sized history.
Well, here's a news item you might have missed. In the United States, prices for pig iron are up. Some market analysts are predicting a healthy future for pig iron sales globally. Not a substance you hear about all that often, is it? Pig iron? I always associate it with a nickname which trade unionists gave to Bob Menzies back in the 1930s. They called him Pig Iron Bob. And the name stuck with him right through his political career until he retired as Australia's longest-serving PM in 1966. So how did Menzies become Pig Iron Bob? Here's historian and Radio National presenter Michael Cathcart. Michael, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil.
What's the background to this story?
Well, this goes back to a time when the trade unions were much more powerful than they are now, where you could have a good old-fashioned strike and everyone got very aggro and agitated. So we're in November 1938. Unionised wharfies are working at Port Kembla, the big steel port in New South Wales, and they're required to load a product from BHP that's called pig iron onto a British ship.
What actually is it?
What's pig iron?
Let's get to that in a moment. Anyway, go on.
onto a British ship, which actually was a tramp steamer. I don't know what a tramp steamer was, but it doesn't sound very dignified, does it?
No.
To mean the captain of a tramp steamer. Anyway, this tramp steamer was called the SS Dalfrom, and it was taking this material, this pig iron, to the Japanese steelworks in Japan. And the reason this was controversial is that these steelworks were making military material for the Japanese army.
Okay. So what is pig iron?
Well, it's a product of smelting iron ore. So you bring iron ore into your smelter, and after phase one, one of the things you've got is this stuff called pig iron. Now, I mean, pig iron sounds as though it's sort of rubbish iron, doesn't it? Something expendable. But it actually is an ingredient in steel. It's an ingredient in wrought iron. So that's why it was controversial.
This is at a time when Japan had invaded China, of course. The attack on Nanjing is still notorious for its brutality. The things that happened there are just almost beyond belief. For the use of biological warfare, we're talking about a very different Japan from the one we know today, aren't we?
Yeah. So this is the Japan that is ultra-military. I mean, there's a kind of fanatical culture of loyalty and fighting unto death, and it was a very, very brutal culture. And they'd invaded China, invaded Nanjing, and this is what the ACTU, the Australian Council of Trade Unions, were so agitated about. They were actually calling for trade sanctions and boycotts against Japan because of this very brutal invasion of China. And there'd already been several cases of union workers refusing to load ships headed for Japan.
Why was the government in denial about what was happening in China?
Well, this is what's so confusing, because there are a lot of contradictions in this story. The Lyons government, Joe Lyons is the Prime Minister of the Conservative government, they'd already limited the export of iron ore to Japan because there were enough people in the government who were worried about Japanese aggression, but they hadn't limited exports of pig iron or scrap metal. So that it is hard to get across. I mean, it seems to me that the concern about Japan didn't really run on party lines. You had people who were anxious about Japan, both on the Liberal and on the Conservative side. But I guess you've also got to take into account that this is the era of the White Australia policy. So a lot of people just didn't care either way. You know, there were Asians fighting Asians, and they just thought it had nothing to do with us. We were selling this stuff to a ready and willing market. What was the problem?
Yes, and there was all sorts of politics, wasn't there, in and around the fact that unions were taking industrial action, and that was seen as a bigger threat possibly than the Japanese making bullets and eventually shooting them at us.
Yeah, well, Robert Menzies, the future Prime Minister, is the Attorney General at this stage. He's a young, keen politician on the up and up. And this was the sort of union action that made Bob Menzies furious. He had a great fear of the mob. He hated unions. He hated them taking this kind of industrial action. He was really in love with the middle class, and he saw unions as the sort of curse of middle class life. So his take on this was that by boycotting this ship bound for Japan, with material that the BHP was, you know, legally selling, that by boycotting this ship, the unions were dictating foreign policy and it wasn't the union's role to tell the government what to do.
That's right. He picked a fight, didn't he? So how serious did it get? Because these weren't namby-pamby union men, were they?
They weren't namby-pamby union men, but Menzies wasn't a namby-pamby conservative. So he decides to bring out a really big gun. And this is a law, an act of parliament called the Transport Workers Act, which is a law that had basically been lying in a drawer for 10 years. And it was a law that gave the government the power to issue licenses to dock workers. So the government could come along and say, unless we approve you, you can't get a job on the docks. And of course, this meant that a government that was anti-union could say, no, I'm sorry, you're in the union. You are actually not a legally recognised person to work on the docks. They could say only non-union labour could work on the docks. And the unionists hated this, of course. They called it the Dog Collar Act. They'd hated it when it was first declared, and they hated it now. And this really was exactly the way to inflame union passion over this whole issue.
Mm. Menzies, that's right. I mean, Menzies was really stirring the possum here, wasn't it? Because he'd found a good way to increase violence and unrest on the docks. So what happened? Did the workers back down?
No, well, not for a while. The unions initially stood fast, and it grew into a lockout of all the ships at Port Kembla. And this is one of those strikes where the whole of the union movement gets its dander up, and it becomes an issue in which big issues of principles are at stake. One of the interesting developments was that the Chinese community in Sydney got involved and started sending food to Port Kembla to help feed the strikers because, you know, that they were so sympathetic with what was happening back in China. And this is when Menzies became known as Pig Iron Bob. So the phrase was used at a union meeting, and it just caught on. And, you know, if you think about how hated Maggie Thatcher was in the miners' strike in the UK in 1984-85, this is the same kind of thing. He was the enemy of the workers as far as the trade unionists were concerned.
Yes, that's right. It was an enduring memory. I remember my father, even when I was, you know, from earliest times, he used to refer to him as Pig Iron Bob.
He called him Pig Iron Bob at over the dinner table.
Yes, and talked about how that's right, that we'd been mining iron, sending it to Japan, and we got it back as bullets. He said so. How did it all end in the end? How was the strike resolved?
Well, they stuck it out. The unionists stuck it out for 10 weeks and 2 days. Mm. And then they got hungry, basically, and they gave in, and they loaded the pig iron under protest, they always say. I don't know what that means. I'm doing this under protest, but I'm loading the ship anyway. So they gave in. I mean, there is a view. I mean, you'll read this in history books. There is a view that the government had a quiet word with the Waterside Workers Union and said, look, for goodness sake, this all has to end. We won't export any more pig iron. We'll give you that undertaking, but for heaven's sake, load this ship so that we can get all this out of the way, which I suppose is the sort of compromise that you want in politics.
Mm. Mm. You could argue, I suppose, that the dispute helped to weaken the White Australia policy, did it?
You could, couldn't you? Because the Chinese had got involved in public life. Chinese Australians were in the newspapers, and Chinese people in Sydney really did win a lot of sympathy for their stand. Because once you saw Chinese people helping workers, then the unions, who were not, you know, famous in this era for their interest in multiculturalism, you know, the unions were a bastion of the White Australia policy. This helped break that down a bit. But it really set the battle lines for Menzies throughout his career. Menzies on the one side and left-wing unions on the other, and they continued calling him Pig Iron Bob in the way that your dad did until the day he got in the rolls and drove off for the last time.
Yeah, Dad was a DLP supporter by this time. But still, I mean, it was a popular view. Of course, I mean, it was reinforced, wasn't it, by the fact that 3 years later, I mean, December 1941, of course, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. The Second World War begins.
Yes. Well, that certainly made the strikers feel vindicated, didn't it? Because suddenly now we're at war with Japan. I mean, the great irony of all this is that the head of BHP at that time, at the time of the strike, was this tough, charismatic, conservative engineer, an astonishing man called Essington Lewis. And he had been to Japan back in 1934, and he was really alarmed by the country's fanatical militarism, by its capacity to manufacture weapons. And he came back sounding the warning. Nevertheless, he's importing or exporting pig iron to Japan. So, you know, these are the contradictions we all live with. But the irony of all this is that in 1940, Menzies put Essington Lewis in charge of the manufacture of munitions. He had nothing to do with musicians, but munitions throughout Australia. So this arch capitalist, this great enemy of government action, becomes a sort of dictator of government control over the whole of manufacturing. And he really effectively puts it on a war footing. And it was an essential part of our war against Japan.
I mean, yes, it was. In those early days, weren't they? In those early war cabinets when Curtin and the others in Melbourne were looking at what was available, the cupboard was very bare.
It was very bare.
In terms of Australia's defence capability.
And yet what the Australian factories achieved in terms of, you know, making rifle sights and weapons, it was an astonishing thing. But whether Menzies pig iron found its way into those bombs that fell on Darwin, I don't know, maybe it did.
I mean, it may. Well.
Who knows?
I mean, who knows? Maybe it did.
Anyway, that's the story. That's how Bob Menzies became. That's why your dad, back in the days when he was supporting the DLP, said that Bob Menzies was pig iron Bob. Do you think he used it affectionately?
No.
Oh, so even though he was a DLP man, he wasn't that keen on Bob.
No, he wasn't keen on Bob. He was probably a Labour man because that had been his background, but he was also a committed Catholic. And so, you know, during the split, of course, he—that's the side, like lots of people, in his position. That's where they went. That's where they ended up.
Maybe we should talk about the DLP in a subsequent conversation.
We should actually, yeah. I think by the time it came to 1972, I think he—I don't know whether he voted for Whitlam or not. Maybe he did. That's a good idea, Michael. Terrific to talk. Thank you.
On you, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.